Why? What made you decide to run for this office?
Well, here's the thing. The United States right now is in a state of health, economic, social crisis, really unlike anything that we've seen since the years between the Great Depression and the end of World War II. And the Democrats and the Republicans are jointly responsible for our failure to prepare emergency systems, neither have any plan for how to end the crisis or emerge from it back onto a road to stability, let alone anything resembling freedom and prosperity. So, contrary to the myth that our problems are caused by their refusal to cooperate, they've actually collaborated perfectly to bring us to this ruin and prevent us from getting back up again. So now more than ever, we need to reject the politics of obscene profits to people and institutions of great wealth, all of which are doing better than ever while the rest of us are suffering, and try something different. That's why I'm here. I'm offering something different. We've done this kind of thing successfully during hard times in the past, and we need to do it again. We should not be having politics as usual right now, and none at all until we're restored to safety and prosperity. And along with that, some significant degree of sustainability and resilience that we have prioritized over pure profit.
What is it that you bring to the table that you feel could do a better job for your constituents?
Well, there's really quite a lot going on there. First of all, Antonio Delgado has not represented the interests of the people of this district, not even close. He has done, like any professional politician, a very good job of retail politics, of going out to press the flesh, of sending responses when people send him questions and things like that. But let's face it, the reality of his voting record is that he was just awarded the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's first special prize. He's only been in office for 18 months, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce cited him as the member of Congress most likely to co-sponsor Republican legislation of things that are advocated by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, of course, is the world's largest corporate lobby. Okay, and they just gave him their very first award of this nature. He's serving them. He's not serving us. The problem that we have here in the 19th District, no matter what you do for a living, whether you're an independent contractor, whether you work for a company, whether you're in agriculture, education, tourism, whatever it may be, is that we are really small and family-owned businesses and operations here. The big monopolies don't have large positions here in our district. But Antonio Delgado serves, the system. He hasn't brought about any anti-monopoly legislation. He's brought a little bit of pork into the district. But he hasn't done a single thing to level the playing field for the businesses of the 19th district. And the reason for that, you just have to look at his donor list like anyone else. This is what I mean about the priority always being profit. We basically have a for-profit electoral system in this country. Whoever receives the highest amount of donations is likely to win, and so that's what we're actually doing. And, I challenge Antonio Delgado. It's a shame that I'm not allowed to come to debates this year, because I challenge Antonio Delgado to actually explain to his constituents what he's done to level the playing field between 19th district businesses and the big international monopolies. And you have to understand what the meaning of a monopoly is. Okay, here's another issue. I was an economics major in college. Okay, Antonio Delgado is a corporate lawyer. Kyle Vandewater is a corporate lawyer. We had this problem with John Faso. Last time I asked this question, wouldn't it be nice to have someone representing this district who's not a corporate lawyer? How does a corporate lawyer know what people in this district need in their lives? Like, that's not how they bill for their time. That's not the interest that they represent. When we have monopoly or oligopoly, meaning just a few companies that control a particular industry, obviously the case with agriculture, one of our biggest industries here, then those industries dictate the price of your products. No matter what your own input costs are, which are going to be higher than the giant companies, the prices are set at the commodities exchange in Chicago. You don't have any say in that. It's not set by farmers. It's set by Wall Streeters wearing suits and ties that sell stock. We can't compete in this district at any level. There is no business in this district. General Motors doesn't have any factories here. Archer Daniels Midland doesn't have any farms in the Hudson Valley. We are all local independent business, and Antonio Delgado is representing monopoly. You could look at his voting record, and you could look at his donor list, and you'll see that they perfectly match. So I actually reject the notion that he's been doing a good job serving the interests of this district. He's been getting away with it looking that way because he's a very good retail politician. He knows how to talk to people, but that's not what he's doing in Congress.
What would you do if elected? What in your view does the 19th district need, and how would you go about doing that?
There's a whole lot to consider here right now. You know, the situation 2 years ago when I ran last time, I ran on a number of policies that would have been highly preventive in creating the situation that we're in right now. And first and foremost among those is, some form of full public health, whether that's going to be a British-style system or more likely and much more manageable here in the United States, a single-payer insurance system, a Medicare for all, a Canadian-style system. We have to detach our health insurance from our employment, okay? When COVID-19 hit, 40 million people lost their jobs. And I cannot believe that the Democratic Party and the Republican Party are both stating unequivocally that they are not considering any form of providing Americans with complete health insurance. How could this be when we're in the middle of a pandemic? People can't go to work. They do need to go to the doctor. They've lost their health insurance because they've lost their jobs. And still, in this crisis that could have been averted if we had given this proper attention, we would have had resilience in our health insurance system and not have it attached to employment and the business cycle. And we wouldn't be in the problem. That's the biggest problem we're having right now, is that people are unemployed due to a pandemic and people have lost their health insurance due to a pandemic. Those two things cannot be reconciled, okay? And by the way, I want to be clear that a proposal that I make does not necessarily have to be a permanent change for the United States. It just has to be done while we're in the state of crisis that we're in. And after we emerge from crisis, we can change back to some other system that's, works in some other way. But the first thing we have to do is admit that the United States is in the greatest crisis that it's been in since the end of that period from 1930 to 1945. And we do not have the means available right now. Neither of the major parties are proposing any system whatsoever to get us back out of it. First and foremost, the health insurance, that should be a no-brainer at this point, an absolute no-brainer for all parties and all people, because we've run out of steam. We had to have learned that the hardest way possible. Beyond that, I would say also, temporarily, we need to provide direct public employment and also financing for local contracting by independent contractors in private business for the creation of clean energy infrastructure, remediating our toxic waste. And we do that for as long as is necessary, because not only is that solving our present and future environmental problems, but it's solving our immediate economic problem and health problem, putting people back to work, giving them health insurance. We can and we must solve unemployment, pollution, climate change, and having our national security tied to a finite resource in foreign countries. We do that all at the same time, right? So, hiring for the things that we actually need done, not in a random way, in a targeted way like that. We need to end all of our wars. We're at war for 19 years. That's too many for any war, and particularly for wars that were not defensive, right? These were fossil fuel acquisition wars. We don't need to be in these places anymore. It's a personal anecdote. Last month I was up on a mountaintop here. We had to climb, working on a wildfire for a couple of days that we got out. And conversation broke out about, if our helicopters weren't all overseas, if we didn't have, 20,000 helicopters sitting idle on military bases, and we could have brought some of that to bear. Look what's happening in California, Oregon, state of Washington, and Idaho right now. Imagine if instead of being at war for 19 years, we had all these helicopters and all these pilots available. We could have had all of these fires put out within the first few days. And instead, we've lost 5 million acres, trillions of dollars of people's entire net worth, hundreds of thousands of people's entire stored net worth as their homes burned and destroyed. So we have to end the wars. We have to stop thinking that policing the entire world is part of American security strategy. It's not. It's a part of policing the private enterprise of multinational corporations that, just like the way a supermarket pays for its own security guard, if you're operating in a volatile place in the world and you're operating for profit, you got to pay your own security freight. You know, the American taxpayer has to stop doing that, because we have too many problems here at home to allow that to happen. So ending the wars, the mechanism for doing that, insist that the United States Constitution be respected. Insist that we only go to war in defensive situations when the president comes before Congress and seeks a declaration of war. If we were respecting the Constitution in how we go to war, we wouldn't have had a single war since the end of World War II, you know, and we certainly wouldn't be in Afghanistan and Iraq for the last 19 years. So that's a big one there, because that is a capital budget of over $1 trillion a year. People keep saying, where are you going to get the money? Where are you going to get the money? Well, that's the first answer right there, first and foremost. All those missiles, all those helicopters, all those airplanes, that's heavy machinery. Tanks, you know, why not build bulldozers instead of tanks? You know, that'll start, you know, building the new green infrastructure that we need. You know, build electrical systems that we're not building in Afghanistan or Libya. Build them right here at home. So all that's in our military budget. Parts of it's in the State Department budget. Parts of it are, in our nuclear arsenal is not even in the defense budget. That's in the Department of Energy. So we need to demilitarize on a substantial level and free up the capital, the scientific research, the money, all of that, more for our domestic needs. I already mentioned that we need to break up the monopolies. The laws have been in place for that since the Teddy Roosevelt administration. For some reason, we're not enforcing them. You know, you would think that someone like Antonio Delgado, he was a corporate defense attorney at one of the world's largest multinational corporate law firms. He should be an expert at applying American anti-monopoly law and bringing about the breaking up of the big private equity firms and the monopolies. But he's not doing that, you know, and I would insist that those laws be applied. I would insist that the Department of Justice do that, and if they're not, that Congress act on their budget until such time as they do. Now, one thing that nobody ever talks about, which is incredibly important for the 19th District because of the type of agriculture that we have here, which is local and family farms. A long time ago, back in the middle part of the 20th century, there was something that was called the Green Revolution. And it was kind of a misnomer, because it wasn't green the way we think of it now, but it was about agriculture, right? That was the age in which industrial agriculture started. Chemical fertilizers, chemical pesticides, giant combines that actually did a really incredible job of dramatically multiplying the yields of our acreage, of our agricultural acreage, turning us into the world's largest agricultural exporter. Basically making it possible to end hunger in America and worldwide, although we never achieved that because we don't distribute, the fruits of our agriculture or any other of our industries in an equitable way. But we did vastly multiply the number of calories per acre that we yield. And as a result of that, food became very cheap and a very low percentage of most people, unless you're in dire poverty, of our annual budgets, and it made it possible for us to go to the movies, go on vacation, and do things with the rest of our money. That really exploded the American economy back there. And so, like, all credit to the agricultural, workers and businesses back in that era that brought that about and really transformed the 20th century. But now we need what I call a new green revolution. The reason that the 19th District family agriculture is near extinction is because industrial agricultural monopolies are destroying the earth with those same petrochemicals, insecticides, herbicides, fertilizers, causing dead zones where we need to be fishing, algae blooms, diseased livestock and finished products, and cancer, along with prices that are much too low for small and environmentally friendly agriculture to compete. If we were to stimulate permaculture farming and regional distribution, that would really bring about both the environmental change we need and a competitive footing for our local agriculture. We also need to get off this horrible, anti-immigrant jag that we've been on. I don't know anybody, no matter how conservative they are, no matter how many generations of their families that have been Republican that are in agriculture, that don't want to be able to keep their labor close to their property and working when they need them, because that labor pool is really not coming from the domestically born population here. So we have to allow immigrant labor to permanently reside where their work is needed. We need to abolish ICE. We have to stop people being swept up off the street. So our farms really need that kind of thing to happen. We need a permaculture revolution that prioritizes local agriculture over the giant monopolies. And we need to free up the labor that works our farms to have permanent work visas and reside where their work is needed right here in the 19th District. We need to improve public education and expand it to include technical employment training. You know, and that Green New Deal isn't going to happen if we don't have enough technically trained people. We need all of this stuff happening. So we need to improve public education. We need to relieve existing student debt. The United States ranks lowest in the entire industrialized world in social mobility, which means that where we're born is where we stay over the course of our lives. Barriers to education are the prime cause of our incredibly low social mobility rate, and as well as the prime cause of so many of our successful industries hiring from overseas. So we need to really reinvest in public education. And this is almost, it's hard to believe after all this time. Here's one thing that's almost on scale of the way we abuse our military spending. We need to legalize marijuana. This used to be a niche issue, but due to what's happening in our prisons and the cost of that and the communities that have been destroyed from the ongoing prohibition, we need to legalize marijuana. Antonio Delgado is against that. Kyle Vandewater is against that. Joe Biden is against that. Donald Trump is against that. And states all over the country are trying to act on their own, even though drug legalization is a federal issue. So we need to act at the federal level. We need to end the war on drugs. We need to provide safe housing and treatment to addicts. It's not a trivial matter. Our existing approach costs us hundreds of billions of dollars a year in unnecessary policing, prosecution, incarceration. And this creates the endless cycle of recidivism and crimes in support of addiction because people are unemployable. They have to check the box that they have convictions. They have no way to go back to a productive life. We are not treating our drug crisis, our addiction crisis, the way we need to. The professional rehabilitation model, the Hazleton model, the 12-step model, it has a success rate of in single digits, basically the same success rate as not going to rehab at all. We need to stop that. You know, we need to stop pretending that if we just make money available to go to rehab, that these problems are going to go away. They're not going to go away because the rehab model doesn't work. Doesn't work. We have to stop that. Running down towards the end of the list now, to whatever degree it remains after we've done all this, which I assure you will not be much, right? If we employ people at good jobs, if we educate people, if we end marijuana prohibition and stop incarcerating people and let them go back to work, most of our poverty problem in this country will be solved. We had 40 million people in this country living below the $12,490 annual income. That's the federal poverty line. Think of that mind-boggling number, $12,490 a year. We had 40 million people living below that when we were supposedly, as Donald Trump would have us believe, at the peak, the historic peak of prosperity and employment. 40 million people were living on less than that, and now the number is much higher. So to whatever degree poverty remains after we do the rest of the things that I've explained, we have to end it. And the way you end it is you just assign the resources needed to end it. That is much less costly, far more humane, far less racist than what we do now to confine and police our impoverished communities. Every area in which we run at the bottom of high wealth nations would go straight to the top just by eliminating poverty. A perfect example, my background, right? Two terms on the school board, public education. People talk all the time about how poorly we do compared to the rest of the industrialized world, that we tend to rank in the 30s in our educational outcomes. But if you strip out the results in our impoverished school districts and only look at the data for the middle class and above districts, we're number one. We're number one in the world. The problem is not poor public education. The problem is poverty. We have poverty and they don't. The ramifications of all of this, now here's the thing is that neither of the major parties are proposing any of these things. You know, these are absolutely unique policies. They're not novel to me. I didn't invent any of them. They're all in discussion in major think tanks. They're all in discussion in academia. They're all things that we've used in the past during previous national emergencies. And so what we've got now, this is really the summary of my campaign, why I'm here, why I'm running on the Green Party line, is that all the problems that we're having right now are a result of policies that were made either by Democrats, by Republicans, or by Democrats and Republicans working together, by the exact thing that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce gave Antonio Delgado an award for doing. Okay? So they are the people that are responsible for the entire litany of these problems. If you look at their platforms and listen to them discussing it and debating it, they are proposing to just do more of what their traditional platforms have said. Well, if you vote for my party, it'll get better. If you vote for, why? Why would it get better? Your party is proposing to do the exact same things that they've always been doing that got us to this, you know, intractable state of crisis that we're in and that we can't get out of. And so if we're going to get out of it, we have to vote for somebody else. It's the only logical solution. If either of the major parties were proposing to do something completely different than what they've been doing all along, in recognition that we're in a moral equivalent of war right now on multiple fronts, right? On social strife, on health, on the economy, on global warming, the fires out in the West Coast. If we would just acknowledge that all of the fronts in which we are on an emergency status right now, why aren't the platforms of either major party using the word crisis or emergency or anything like that? They're not even acknowledging where they've brought us. And so they're obviously not going to take us back out. You know, we have to acknowledge that that is the situation. And you don't have to take my word for it. You can read the platforms of Kyle and of Antonio and of Joe Biden and of Donald Trump. And you can see that nobody is even recognizing formally and structurally that this is the set of conditions that we're in, that these conditions are emergencies. And if they're not calling it an emergency, and if they're not proposing anything different other than just, you know, elect my side instead of the other side, then why would anyone believe that we're getting out of this? We're going to stay stuck where we are, Dave, for a very long time unless we change the way that we vote. I don't run as a Democrat. I don't run as a Republican because if I did, I would be responsible for acknowledging the donors and what they want. Because if I didn't do that, my party wouldn't get the donations that they need to thrive. That's why people have to look at independent candidates from minor parties, and stop voting for Democrats and Republicans. That's the bottom line. If you vote for Democrats or Republicans, you're going to get more of the same. You're going to get attention being given and resources to monopolies, to fossil fuel companies, to the military-industrial complex, to the for-profit health insurance companies. That's just going to continue exactly the same way it's always been. And we're never going to break out of the cycle until we ourselves break out of our own voting habits.
So I want you to boil it down to a couple of bullet points for me. Give me a good solid argument. I'm on my way in to vote right now. I'm going to go to the polls. Why should I vote for Steve?
Really, for the entire list of reasons I just gave you. I am trained in the field of economics. I've been an independent contractor since I'm 15 years old. My first job was delivering the daily news on a bicycle. You know, I'm a musician. I'm a volunteer firefighter for 17 years. My approach is, to the state that America is in right now is the same as when my pager goes off when someone's called 911. Go in there, solve the problem, right? Resolve the situation, solve the problem, and then if you manage to do that successfully, then you will finally be at liberty to decide how you want to fine-tune things and restore things back to some state of normalcy. But when there's an emergency, you acknowledge it as an emergency, you treat it as an emergency, and you do what needs to be done. Right now, we are in a state of crisis, as I said. Our health is in crisis, our economy is in crisis, our national security is in crisis, our social relations are in crisis, The economy is in crisis. I cannot really think of, the climate, the environment is in crisis, right? Fires everywhere. I cannot think of a single front that is part of the ordinary day of an American citizen that is not in crisis right now. And the reason that you should vote for me instead of either of the major party candidates is because I am viewing these things as what they are, as emergencies, as crises, the way a firefighter would look at them and say, let's get the wet stuff on the red stuff. You know, that's what we say. Get the wet stuff on the red stuff. You know, all your other problems your chance of getting injured goes down when you put out the fire. The chance that a victim is going to die of smoke inhalation ends when you put out the fire. The solution to everything, really, is put out the fire. The people that have been pouring fuel on these fires for decades and decades now are not the people that are going to come in and do that. You need someone like me, someone who is not beholden to any financial interests, that is just an ordinary citizen here in the district. I have a legislative history, 2 school board terms that were very successful. I've been a legislator and an advocate to legislators, and I think that the only way we're going to get out of this right now is to vote outside the major party system.